I'm not completely sold on titanium.
Why not?
I like the look of that from a distance. Do you?
So the Omegas dropped a whole bunch of quietly new planet oceans.
Very quietly.
And I keep waiting for them to upgrade or just like redesign slightly the planet ocean, because I think the last design was 2016.
What about the white face? That just came out.
The moon watch.
Yeah.
I think it's lovely, but a manual winding watch, like, unless you're wearing it every single day.
It's a problem.
It's a little bit of a pain in the...
What about the Snoopy swatch, the moon watch? I know.
Can we just go back and... Back to, do we really prefer titanium over steel, Diana?
Yes. Yeah.
You do?
It's white.
Because it's...
Okay, feel this is nice.
Cooler.
It's lighter.
It's lighter.
I'm kind of more into the like brushed steel kind of look, like the
yeah, I like
metals that aren't as bright, right. Like they're not as shiny. Yeah,
I like a bit of a polish on. Anyways, I it's nice, but I don't know.
I do like the classics though, the ones that look like, you know, old fashioned.
Some of the classics are lovely. They're really nice. Okay, anyways, it was just a question that was burning on my chest because I was
literally
looking at them.
These are the things that keep you awake at night.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love watches. So the Dirty Dozen.
Oh, yeah, the Dirty Dozen.
So this is something we were talking about, in part because we got asked by...
a movie?
Can you zoom in on my cup?
Was.
No, this
thank,
may be...
Thank enough. You, Helena, for the cup.
This is not intended to be a copyright infringement, the name of our episode.
But that's true. We've been talking about, in part because we had a question from one of the people who watches the podcast, so thanks for that, asking about strategies that prosecutors use in cross-examination.
Yeah.
So
we start talking about that, but this is a very good lineup of 12.
The Dirty Dozen lists of things that we have concerns about.
So dirty, says Marcy in the audience. She whispers.
You know, and the number one we got to talk about a little bit, because if I'm going to let you take the lead on this, but I want to focus on the first one for a little bit.
Okay. I've experienced this one recently.
What is the first one on the list?
Oh, I guess. Unduly repeat cross-examination questions. It's so annoying. You prepped your... Why are you nodding?
We just kind of went through it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, really? Because, you know, we've seen this happen so many times.
Yeah, I know.
Where they repeat, they ask a question, they get an answer, then they repeat the question as if you didn't answer the question.
And then they try to catch you off guard 10 questions later and ask the same question.
Yeah,
what are you doing?
And in this case, it was the same question pretty much 10 times in a row, almost not reworded at all, almost precisely the same.
And one of the other techniques is that they'll actually go through a sequence of questions that are completely open-ended, asking you to repeat essentially your evidence in chief, which is when your lawyer is examining you, when your client is testifying. And oddly enough, it proves to be a challenge for some clients because... Right. They try and mix them up, but keep asking open-ended questions and keep going back and repeating themselves. After a while, either a client becomes quite vexed at it, and starts to lose their shit a little bit, or they become a bit
flustered
because it's highly repetitive. And we can certainly object to it. But one of the things we try not to do too often is protect the client too much under cross-examination.
Object too often, it looks like you're trying to shield them in some way.
Right, yeah. But I'm trying to be charitable here. What do you think is the strategy behind repeating the same question?
To create internal inconsistencies. That's what it is. If it is a challenge for a Crown attorney because they have an idea of course, what an accused is going to testify to, but they don't have like a statement like we do. So they're not able to sit down and map out a very detailed cross. They can map out a cross because it's kind of obvious what they're going to be testifying to.
Right.
But then one of the, low-hanging fruit is to try and go after the content and mix it up and keep asking the questions to try and create internal inconsistencies. That's really the value.
And the problem is, and I think one of the goals is to create some frustration in the person. And so... what often happens is the person then ends up changing their answer, thinking they're not going to get asked any question unless they somehow answer it differently.
Right. Trying to please the questioner.
Yeah. And then they're, and
that's
they
a very good point.
Yeah. And they can get confused too, because there's like, but didn't you say? And then sometimes the Crown's interpretation of what they said isn't necessarily the truth. And, we had a brilliant answer from our client at Course, and I don't see the difference. You know, like, I just, sure, okay, you see this different, but I just don't see it that way. And there's nothing wrong with sticking to your guns, you know, when the person keeps repeating the same thing. It's just be like, well, my answer's still the same.
The client, and, you know, as advice, the client had a very good comeback in a number of instances. One of them you said is like, I'm sorry, I just don't really see the difference, mm-hmm. Which had a good effect. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was when the Crown was trying to establish some inconsistency with a prior testimony, which was kind of a similar tactic. And the client said, you know, I just want to make sure that my evidence is understood.
Right. That was really well
That's
articulated.
That's a smart, smart response.
Yeah. Because there was testimony, you know, given on a previous occasion. And so then they're saying, well, you didn't say as much. You only said this portion of the answer before. Well, mm-hmm. Now I'm clarifying because I want to make sure I'm understood this time.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
And you know, an accused in a trial shouldn't be shy of explaining why something is something.
And you are permitted to explain answers too. So 100%. You don't always just have to say yes or no. If you want to clarify why the answer is yes, and sometimes you do agree with the suggestion being right. made to you, you're saying yes, but only because of this reason.
Yeah. So unduly repeating questions in cross-examination is a number one.
Okay. Next. Question solely to harass or embarrass the witness. I've seen this, as I'm sure you have.
Do you have an example?
Just trying to humiliate them by saying, how could this possibly happen? Are you suggesting ABC? That's just absurd. I've had that, where my client is made to feel almost like crap because it's like, that's a ridiculous proposition, sir. Are you suggesting ABC? And my client's like, yeah.
yeah, admissions against interest, where you're admitting to something that's really not, you know, all that flattering, is actually important to be able to do that when it's accurate, because sometimes we all do things we're not proud of. It doesn't make it a crime,
right,
to have said or done something stupid.
Yeah, I think that's the more common example. So for example, you know, where a client may be, so typically we deal with cases where people in relationships, since we're drawing back on this one. So one where, you know, going after the client because they were a penny pincher during the relationship, simply because the client was a penny pincher during the relationship, and basically embarrassing him for not being the gentleman that we all think the person should be in a relationship. It's not criminal. It's not illegal. It's not immoral. There's nothing wrong with it. You can be a penny pincher, and you may be quite wise at the end of the day, but it's geared towards harass or to embarrass someone.
And I would point out another kind, because we're talking about embarrassment, that everyone's always concerned about complainants being asked unnecessary questions about their sexual life and sexual persona. But they forget that it's just as embarrassing to an accused person to have to get up in court and testify about personal details and habits of their sex life. And I think there are some gratuitous questions sometimes from Crown in order to, you know, solicit or elicit information, unnecessary information about the client's sex life.
And to destabilize the client for the balance of the cross, right?
Mm-hmm.
You embarrass them, humiliate them, they're destabilized.
You put them off their footing.
You put them off their footing. All the hours we spend preparing them are all of a sudden, they're rattled.
And it is very frustrating to the client too, given like our pretrial applications, if we want to ask any question of anything of a sexual nature, which would include things, minor things like flirting, hugging, kissing, you know, nothing really graphic. And yet our client is subjected to all these questions without any applications being required for their personal history.
Isn't that really frustrating?
Yeah. And it kind of ties into the next thing on your list too, which I think you're kind of getting into, which
intentionally
is
intentionally
insulting or abusing the witness. So insulting like penny pincher, right?
Yeah. And that comes out also in other cases, like sometimes in cases like homicide cases, if you have an accused testify, they may go after the individual for certain characteristics or other things to basically abuse or insult someone. And we had that a long time ago in a homicide back up in Lindsay, Ontario, where it was really going after the character of the accused, not really related to any sort of probative reasoning as to why he would have committed a homicide, but it wasn't good.
And I think one of the best responses, as we kind of said before too, is like if somebody wants to say, well, don't you think that was callous? And like, yeah, looking back, it probably was. You know, I could have been, you know, a little nicer about the way I said that or did that.
So that's a great point. So, you know, it's often very important if a witness is testifying and accused and there's certain behaviors that in retrospect look unpleasant or not the most thoughtful, to own it. Yeah. And but to, I mean, say, you know.
In terms of insults, though, I mean, there is some decorum in terms of officers of the court and how they can word things. Like, you're not going to have a prosecutor say, "Isn't it true, sir, that you're an asshole?" You know, like, they're not allowed to do insults like that, right?
No,
like,
and I have to say, in at least the cases we have, you know, even with the repetitive questioning, I've seen fairly respectful cross-examination of accused persons in our trials. There's been a few that's been problematic.
And I think it's more the old school crowd. Remember, we, in one of our previous episodes, we talked about...
It was way different back then.
Yeah, it's like, "Sir, you believe in the Bible, don't you?" We covered that examination, cross-examination. And I don't see it happening as much now. If there's insults happening now, they're way more subtle, as you're saying. They're kind of...
It was much more Wild West when they started.
There were outright insults.
People would say all sorts of
It was bad.
Ask a question to elicit evidence that's not admissible. Very good point. Example.
Well, we've actually had this where we've had some pretrial applications where we're saying, okay, you know, the Crown's not going to get into this type of evidence. Mm-hmm. They don't want the complainant to be asked about certain things. Then in cross-examination of the accused person, they go and ask a question that directly, you know, asks them to talk about prior sexual history. And then there's like, I'm sorry, can I answer that?
Well, that is a careful accused who would then say to a question like that, "I'm sorry, am I allowed to answer that question because of the ruling?" That's a very good way of handling it.
Mm-hmm. It is, but
it's more than that. It's a way of asking a certain question, not just inadmissible evidence that would be about, for example, in cases we deal with, but it could, through the back door, try and get in bad character evidence or propensity evidence.
That's right.
That's where it f-ing pisses me off the most, especially when you have a multi-count information or indictment, and there's a number of accounts, and of course there's rules as to how you get in bad character evidence or evidence that fits to others. There's some way that you can ask questions to try and elicit evidence that would lead towards impermissible reasoning. Mm-hmm. And that can happen very
easily. Well, this kind of gets into an area which I think I've referred to before as like sort of like, you know, hypocrisy on the side of the prosecutor, where if it was us trying to ask similar questions, they'd say, "Well, this is peripheral. This has nothing to do with the allegation. You know, it's like, it's unnecessary and it will distract from the core of the, you know, of the subject matter of the charge." And yet, you know, if there looks like they can get some bad character evidence in, they'll go exactly into those peripheral areas.
Of course.
Things that aren't really relevant.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, all lawyers have to be much more careful about, is being sensitive to the seepage of this character evidence and being right up front to prevent it. But that's a good one.
Ask questions that elicit privileged information.
Michael?
Cross-examination on doctors' appointments, cross-examinations on therapy sessions, stuff that they know they can't go into because it's privileged, among others.
Yeah, like, we had that.
You had it recently?
I'm glad you put this here because so if a complainant testifies, so how have you felt after these events? Mm-hmm. Well, I've had to go to therapy and I have PTSD and I don't go out anymore and I don't trust men, women, or dogs.
Cats are okay.
Cats are okay though. No.
Or cats. And we can't ask a question about that without bringing an application because we're really statute barred by Section 270 of the Criminal Code.
For good reason. You know, it's, people should feel like they're safe to go to therapy without that, you know, their personal therapy being disclosed.
Except that when you ask that question for what's the relevance? So let's talk about this for a moment. So you've got a complainant in a sex assault case and Crown asks, "How has this impacted you?" "Well, I've got PTSD. I'm attending therapy. I'm in treatment. I don't go out anymore.
I have a support cat."
What do you do with that?
Well, we're not allowed to suggest that they're in therapy for another reason.
Right.
But first of all,
the problem.
First of all, we haven't had any disclosure of that in the statement. Let's assume that for a moment.
It was
okay.
Never mentioned.
Okay. So that just comes out. So we, I sit there and I just go, "F***ing asshole." But
further to that.
Then
yeah. Our guy has asked.
But just let's drill down on this for a moment, because let's start here. Because I know it's of the accused, but just now you've got me going. What do you do with that? It's designed to elicit an emotion in a trier of fact. If you're judge alone, a judge will go, okay, well, there's not much I can do with that. But if you're in front of a jury, you're going to have to get a direction to the jury as to what they do with that. And as I've said before, you can't take the pea out of the pea soup, right? No, once they've heard it, it's a problem. And we don't know what it is. We would have to bring an application to get access to records. In order to do that, we have to establish there's something relevant there.
Good luck.
It's not a fishing expedition.
Right. I've done that twice in my career.
Right.
Well, to tie this back to what we were just saying, too, about inadmissible evidence, that Crown often, you know, tries to put in hearsay evidence, which is being allowed more and more for narrative purposes and such.
Love that word.
But in this case, they also had a witness who was directly being asked, you know, did you notice her character change from the night that you were told about this? And it was the same thing. The only intention is to bolster her claim that she had PTSD, which, of course, we've never actually heard that phrase.
Yeah, but there's nothing we can do about it.
Now, this is the kind of thing that you would put into a sentencing thing. If the person's found guilty, then it becomes relevant what the impact is.
Well, actually, then you may actually be entitled to some evidence.
You'll get a report.
That's the joke. But in Cross, you know, we're statute barred. We can stop and say, okay, well, we're going to bring an application across on that. It's going to really not get you very far, and it's going to derail everything. But then the point is, when your client's testifying, the question is, well, after these events, did you have to see anybody about this?
No, he's saying nothing like that even happened, so why in the world would he need to see a therapist? But even if he did, it's completely irrelevant.
It is, and there can be points where you know, questions of your client could lead to privileged information.
Right. Mm-hmm. And again, it derails the client. Why is she asking me about my therapy sessions? Help? Joe? Right?
That's a good point.
Let's see.
Aggressive questioning that crosses the line to abusive.
I find this interesting because it's mostly defense lawyers who are demonized for being aggressive.
Yeah, towards witnesses.
And, being too harsh and they go on and on about how scary it is to testify. Well, it's scary for accused people as well.
I just had this experience with this Crown was just machine gunning my poor client on the stand in Cross. Just like she was even tongue-tying herself. The questions were coming out so fast. And I just had to get up and say, can you slow down? I can't even keep track with what you're saying. And the judge just kind of said, well, Mr. Burry, you know, it is a trial tactic. Yeah, well, it doesn't look like it's working because my client can't even answer the damn question. So can you slow it down?
Yeah, and you know, there will be many times a judge will say, I'm sorry, I got to make notes.
Yeah, well, that too.
I can't keep up with this.
I understand when she's, you know, she's the hawk, she's trying to, you know, go for the kill. You might accelerate the pace of your questions at a certain point, but this was from beginning to end.
I got to tell you, there are points if you start to rapidly, as a defense lawyer, go after somebody, a judge will give you certain leeway, but you'll be pulled back on
that. Yeah, exactly.
100%. But some, like in your case, that was allowed to go on through the entire Cross.
The entire Cross. And I objected 3 or 4 times. I said, come on.
And there's some stuff that I think that accused people is like they're kind of in shock when they get a sense of how things are going because they're not used to people pointing their finger and saying, you know, you did this thing.
You did this. You did that. You did this.
To them, it's just like massively aggressive, but it's a fair enough thing.
I prefer to see a Crown going, you took this person into a room and you knew they were vulnerable and this is what you did to them. Much better than never asking the question in the first place.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called Brown and Dunn, where you have to put your version of
in
events.
In Canada, it's called that. It's
Brown and Dunn.
Based on
I know, I keep
case.
Forgetting people watch from other. But you have to put your version of the case to the opposing witness, right?
And I know lawyers in the States who are shocked that we have to do that. They think it's completely unfair. Right. But there's a good reason for it.
I think it's highly effective.
It is.
And you know how I do it. I don't at the end go, I'm going to suggest to you the following. I hit them throughout. And I do it in a thematic way in order to make my point. So by the time my client hits the stand, the judge or the jury already knows what my defense evidence is and is already thinking about it. Not doing that, I think, is absolute folly. And I've seen lawyers in the United States do that, regardless of what that rule is. So if you're not doing that, you're not doing your job. But leaving that aside,
well, the main reason is
you're an accused in the stand, and I Brown and Dunn them, right? I go right at the beginning, did you sexually assault them? Did you do this? Did you do that? Okay, and then later on in my examination, chief, I'll say, well, did you send that message because you were apologizing that you sexually assaulted the person? No, absolutely not. I was apologizing because I was a dick. I didn't drive them home afterward or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then the Crown comes along and ask them peripheral questions to try and create inconsistencies about a certain part of their evidence, but never goes to the core of the allegation. How do you feel about that? Send us a message, because what I've done in front of a jury.
We're not live streaming, so they can't just.
I know, but once it drops, we can get messages and stuff.
We'll react then.
So in front of a jury, I've said to a jury, how do you feel convicting somebody when the Crown didn't even have the decency to ask the client if he did it?
I know.
That's a good point.
And of course, I've never lost any of those trials.
For fairness, you know, the reason that they put that rule in is that the person whose story is being challenged should have an opportunity to say that they agree with it or don't agree with it, and to give a response to the suggestion of that is the thing that took
to
place.
To me, it
That's
just
the core
seems
reason
that
why they have it.
Both the complainant and the accused need to be confronted with the allegation from either side, period. If you don't, I think an adverse inference should be drawn.
Pretty basic, isn't it?
So,
where were we?
No, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh, the classic. Go ahead, you do this one.
Well, this comes out in a few different ways, but the main thing is asking the accused why the complainant would make up an allegation. And we've called that before the forbidden question, because it has a very subtle way of reversing the burden of proof. Because now as soon as that question is out there, not to say that some people aren't asking themselves anyways, well, I can't figure out why this person would lie, to put it to them, it then causes the accused person to have to give a reason.
Scramble.
Or be found guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, well, if you can't give us a reason, then you must be
therefore,
guilty of it.
Yeah.
So it's
most,
very
most courts are alert to the fact you can't ask that question. But there was days when you could get away with it. And it still can come in when you say in other ways. There's still subtle ways you can try that certain questions, try and get the accused to comment on the state of mind of the complainant.
So, sir, so she's making this up, accused?
Well, why would this happen if what you're saying is true?
Right.
Yeah.
There's tricks around this forbidden
fruit. And they can also just go into an area of, well, would you agree that this person you got along quite well?
Right.
They never showed any animosity towards you in the past.
Right.
So leading up to that is kind of implying there's no reason.
That's right.
Without
directly
saying it.
She left your apartment right after, didn't she? Mm-hmm. And then she went to the hospital.
So can you explain why she would have taken those actions? Well, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Well, given what you're telling us, why on earth would she go to the hospital?
Right. Very subtle.
But there is a slight sort of leeway on that when the defense suggests a motive. And then the Crown can address whether or not that motive has any weight to it.
Still don't think you can. It's not permissible to ask, why would somebody do something?
No.
Not why in general, but they can address the alleged motive.
They can attack the motive, but not get them in the state of mind of the complainant.
Which ties into the next one.
To the next one. Can't ask a witness whether any other witness is lying.
Or what they're thinking.
Right.
Yeah. You can ask somebody what they observed and what they saw.
Right.
What they took from their observations. But you can't actually say.
Why would the previous witness make that up, sir?
Yeah. Or they'd say, would you agree that she was feeling upset or something like that? Would you agree that she was feeling rage? It's like, I don't know what she was feeling. I can just tell you what I saw. Right. So you can't ask what somebody's feeling.
She was scared of you, sir, wasn't she?
Yeah, right.
Right.
So
classic.
Yeah, we were looking at that too, in terms of odd questions that sometimes seem appropriate, but really you're asking somebody to mind read.
Right.
And
but it still happens a lot. That's the funny part. It still happens.
This
but
is something we all
are
fault.
They telling? Are they lying? That can come out too. It's just like, well, you know, especially with an accused person who's there throughout the whole trial, you heard this other witness say such and such. Are they lying about that?
Right.
Yeah, that most judges will interrupt there and
slap someone. Ask compound questions. Well, I think we're all guilty of that.
We are. I try very hard to be careful and methodical with the questions and make sure I'm asking one point. But every so often it comes out as two questions in one, and it sometimes happens because you're the other thing is editorializing.
Mm-hmm. Give an example so people get what that means. Compound question. Or Diane.
I'm thinking, it was like, isn't it true that when you were in this place, you know, if it's a leading cross-examination question, you're in this place, such and such a thing was happening, and then you did this, right? So then you've got, first of all, do they agree they were in that place?
Right.
Right. Second of all, was that other thing happening? And the first, and then the third is, did you actually take this action?
It's actually two questions in one. So you may be stating a position and then premising a question on it, mm-hmm. and then it becomes a compound question.
Right.
And part of that also, I think, ties into
editorial. And why can't you have a compound question, though?
Because it's not fair. Because the witness has to answer one question.
How do you answer it?
You have to answer one fact.
You can get lost to trying to answer one part of it without answering the other. So you want to make sure that you have a clear answer to each suggested aspect of the question.
Exactly.
Or it gets a little convoluted.
Of course you went to the house because you intended to kill that person. Well, I never went to the house.
Right.
But there's that other part. I mean, that's not really great way of phrasing it,
but it's just an example. Yeah,
the thing that I don't, you know, the thing that becomes a real issue is the editorializing on questions.
Oh,
and,
God, yeah.
and we do that. You know, sometimes I go, well, that's very interesting, you raise that X and here's why,
right.
Or you, how is that one phrase? It was very interesting. You remember this for no reason, and then you make a comment at the end of it.
Right.
And the comment or the characterization of what the answer would be is editorializing on it. And that is not helpful. Or prefacing, you have to be careful when you preface your questions, and Crown attorneys can do this, that you're not putting in an editorializing comment and then asking the question. That happens. And sometimes
that's still common, yeah.
And sometimes that's part of the drama of a case. I got to be honest, you can't completely sanitize it, because especially if you're in front of a jury, sometimes that's a lot of fun.
And I noticed, like, because, you know, when I've seen you do it, it's usually because you're well into the cross-examination, and there's certain things you've already covered, and so you're trying to get to another point, and so you combine things that have already been talked about with the new place you want to go to. And then, yeah, fair enough, okay, they didn't necessarily agree to those things earlier, so separate out.
But when you get them to agree, and you have that, you can use that as a foundation of your question. And sometimes editorializing, although not technically allowed, is helpful.
No, what I love
and Crown and defense can do it. And it's,
I love when the complainants editorialize instead of just answering the question. And,
oh God, yeah.
And then you're, you know, so how many times have you said this?
Well, that's exciting. Thank you for that.
Are you done yet?
Do you remember my question? Because they don't actually answer the question.
My question, yeah. Any question where the prejudicial effect outweighs the probative value? Well, we've kind of covered that, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we have. We've
covered
that one. Yeah, but it is good just to talk about, because that is language people might come across. There's always an assessment in terms of whether an area of questioning is permissible, mm-hmm. where you decide, does it have probative value in the first place? Does it contribute to the main question of the trial? Or is it going to distract? And if it does have some probative value, what's is the negative effect sufficient enough, especially in sexual assault cases? You know, it might have a minor probative value, but the prejudicial effect, the you know,
is bigger.
Outweighs it.
Yeah. Right. Answer any question the examiner knows the witness cannot answer.
Right.
I've seen that. You've seen that.
Yeah. Well, so again, they'll be asking about something that is
they'd have no way of knowing
that they won't necessarily have knowledge of, and it's just simply to show them. It's silly sometimes to do that. I'm trying to think of a good example.
Well, if they've testified they weren't at a scene in cross, Crown's already elicited, and the answer was, I wasn't there. And then the Crown says, well, what color was the car there? Or something like that, right? Like, what color was the car
at
that
scene? They keep insisting on facts and questions after a person has said, I'm not in a position to have given you any of that information.
Right.
And that happens often.
Or like we mentioned earlier, there's a pretrial ruling that certain subject matter can't be testified to earlier on. And then in cross-examination, they get asked to answer a question precisely about the things that they've been ruled they can't. Like we said, then you could just say, well, I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Got to be on your toes for that.
Yeah. Or someone else's thoughts, what's in their mind, right? I had that happen a lot in my recent trials. How's he supposed to know what she was thinking? It's impossible.
Well, you knew that she was vulnerable to you, correct?
Yeah, right.
I didn't know.
How did I know? How was I supposed to know?
You knew that she was dependent on you for X, Y, and Z. I had no idea.
Right.
That's very dangerous.
Yes.
And we've seen this in the exploitation type of cases.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yeah. That's where that creeps up. Last but not least, a question that has no purpose other than to elicit hearsay.
So hearsay, we kind of mentioned earlier, that quite often the Crown will try and bring in hearsay evidence, often in order to give demeanor evidence about... and so a hearsay statement, just to be clear, is anything that's said at a court. Mm-hmm. So it's not under oath. And even more often, it's things that people were told by somebody else, but they didn't directly witness.
Right. Here's another example, which is a little bit different, but it's getting in evidence that they would not otherwise be able to get in. You knew that your ex-girlfriend's roommate never wanted to see you when you came to the apartment.
Right, yeah. It was very specific.
Think about that for a moment. That is premised on the fact that the complainant had told the roommate about some illegal act that the accused did. And therefore, by knowing that she didn't want to be there, somehow supports the prior consistent
statement. Which requires the complainant having told the accused person right. that the other person didn't want to be there because they were told something.
Talk about a loaded question that gets impermissible reasoning and hearsay in and prior consistent statements, which is generally a hearsay statement as well, but sometimes is admitted for other purposes. That is something which we've seen, and you have to really be alert to it, because as it first comes out, you're like, well, we heard that person testify, but they're trying to give him knowledge of that, which then would support the legitimacy of the complaint. That's really what it is.
I think I need an Advil.
It just goes to show that you know, so it was a very interesting question that our viewer wanted us to cover, because all the things that you have to be alert to when your client is being questioned, and it's a nerve-wracking experience because you're there, you want to protect your client, but it's hard because you have the instinct to protect your client, but you need to have them stand on their own. It's like, you know, how far do you go with your own children to protect them from certain things?
It's the taking the training wheels off moment.
It's taking the because you want them to stand on their own.
Right.
And be able to answer these questions. And that's why, you know, we explain, and some of the most important advice is, and sometimes it's so hard, please listen to the question and please just answer the question.
And think about
Try and think about why you're being asked the question.
Right. Don't try and do an analysis of you know, because it's when I'm cross-examining complainant and just, I can see she's thinking, I go, you're thinking about where I'm going with this, aren't you?
Right.
Right? And that's when you catch them trying to manipulate the evidence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It seems basic, but it's hard because when a person is testifying and their life is on the line and their liberty is on the line, they want to make sure they get it right. Part of the problem is they can't detach from being the accused, and you're actually asking them to just be a witness.
Yeah.
Please just be a witness. Please just answer the questions. Let me worry about everything else. It's hard.
It's hard, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd kind of looked at, too, just the general things that isn't just for prosecutors, but overall for both sides, some of the main goals as you're getting evidence out in court, and the evidence as it comes out is not the entire trial. There's closing submissions, at which point the prosecutor and the defense lawyer will then present to the judge, this is what you've heard, this is what I think you should take away from it. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of the process in cross-examination is just to try and establish inconsistencies, contradictions, and to also try and get certain aspects of information out that they intend to use in their closing submissions to make a certain point or claim about.
Well, often also you will want through cross-examination, which is the great line from, as it's Seaboy or in other cases, you don't want to deny the accused the ability to get the building blocks of their own defense. And so often in cross-examination, you are establishing facts one by one, which will then build upon the narrative of your own client when they testify. That's incredibly important. It may not be an inconsistency. It may not be some form of an exaggeration or contradiction, but it's the building blocks of your own defense. And that's important because you can move a witness to a certain position where then obviously the answer is what your client is saying.
Right. And it is an adversarial process, but at the same time, we've made this point a number of times, the prosecutors have a duty to try and get to the truth. And they don't have, their job is not to get as many convictions as possible.
No, they don't win or lose.
And most Crown are very aware of that obligation, yeah. And their questions tend to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, we've in the last, 3 months alone, we've had quite a few trials. And I have to say, one of them I thought did a very good cross-examination. Nothing wrong with it. Others were quite, they were pointed, they were good. But I thought, it was not a... it was not a demeaning cross-examination. There, what I liked so much about it, and I guess maybe our experience is different than others, but I don't think so. I mean, I've really seen, a civility in the way we approach these cases. There's sometimes it gets heated. Sometimes there's really an attack, but in most of them, there's really doing the job, but doing it on a professional civil basis, which I think is very good to all parties.
Yeah, the Wild Wild West has died off, I think.
Yeah,
died off, but I think also, we came through a period of time where we were really in uncharted waters.
Yeah, no rules, right? Uncharted waters.
And then we've got these rules, and then what do you do with this? What do you do with that? Then there's a lot of argument about how unfair it is to an accused, and we still agree that there's a lot of unfairness. Yeah. And we've discussed the case law. But by and large, I have to say, our system, I think, does strive to try and get at the answer. It's unfortunately some of the rules from the courts that make it very hard to really get at the truth. There are obstacles to your client getting out evidence that's relevant.
Yeah.
There really is. Like, we're generally successful with it. We reviewed in a previous one, the new decision from Supreme Court of Canada, the Kruk decision, common sense is back, but there are still certain aspects that just make it it's tougher. Right. And you have to be really careful about it. And that means you got to be really careful about what happens in cross, because the playing field is not even.
And one of the points, I guess, that relates to what we're talking about now is that there are some pernicious stereotypes about especially male accused that can sort of infect some of the lines of cross-examination, where the prosecutor is expecting people to believe certain things, especially because men tend to be larger,
aggressive,
way more, and
they
count on a stereotype about men being aggressive or sexual opportunists.
Well, we hope this answered the question of, sort of tactics that's used in these cases, but I think it was a helpful review.
Yeah,
I think so.
So thank you, everybody, and we have pillows.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my goodness. That just tells me how out of shape I am.
I gotta
don't forget
order
to like,
pillow.
Comment, subscribe, and share if you like these videos and want to see more.
And again, I know I keep harping on this, but we do get emails and questions, and it's incredibly helpful so that we can answer some of the questions that you have. I forgot there's another one that I'm going to have to put into a format for us, but please keep commenting and sending us your emails. Thank you very much.
See you Sunday night.
Good night.
Yay!